You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. Now, remember when the Carters, Jay-Z and Beyoncé got their own private tour of the Louvre? They didn't just look at the artworks. While they were there, they filmed the video for this song. There you go, the Carters with Ape Shit, and that video for the video for that particular song made in the Louvre in Paris. And now, courtesy of the French nation, we can all be the Carters. We are invited to visit the Louvre from home. The largest art gallery in the world, which was once the home to the French kings, has now opened its collection covering 10,000 years of history to the people of the world. All you need to do is to log on to louvre.fr.en. /en/online tours. I'll give that web address out again before the end of the item, and we'll also tweet it. But on Arena, we've asked Jess Fahey to take the tour for us, and she joins me now. I love that song that was that had its video made in the Louvre itself. But the director of the Musée du Louvre, Jean-Luc Martinez, has said that for the first time, anyone can access the entire collection of works from a computer or smartphone for free, whether they are on display in the museum, on loan, even long-term, or in storage. There's a lot of material to get through here in terms of the number of works apart from anything else, Jess.
Yes, it's an extraordinary number of works. And of course, that's going to make it a little bit difficult if you wanted to try and see everything. But they've really put, I think, a lot of work into making it accessible as possible, making it as user friendly as possible, even if you're on your phone, so that you can find what you're looking for in a variety of different ways. And the sort of idea of opening it up in this way, you know, for us art historians, we're, of course, over the moon. But it also follows on from, weirdly enough, the original sort of idea from the French Revolution of taking, you know, the collection away from the church and the monarchy and giving it to the people. So this is like our modern version of that, I suppose.
480,000 artworks of art, 10,000 years of history. And they've divided that up into eight curatorial sections. But let's talk about maybe, you know, how you might even approach the website, which could be daunting. At least you're at home, so you can make a fool of yourself by yourself if you're getting lost. First of all, we go on to the homepage, and language is an important detail here. You can get it in several languages.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, the thing about something like this is that the expectation would be that it would just be in the, you know, home language, if you like. But the fact that they have expanded that to make it, again, much more accessible is important. So from the homepage, you can, you know, first of all, choose your language, and then you have a few options as to what you might want to do. So how you're going to visit it. So you can choose from the palace, the gardens, or the collection. And the palace really just is more a sort of quick way to get into the highlight tour, pretty much. And there's a few other things on that page as well. So it might suggest a theme to you of looking, say, at just Islamic art. So it brings you that way. The gardens is more about actually being outside in the garden and what cafes open and what time and those kind of things. So it's a bit more practical. But the one that's really special is the collections. So this is where you have, again, many options of how you're going to navigate it. The one I enjoyed the most was the interactive map, because I know this map from having been there, and it's usually just paper and it's usually quite complicated. And even if you have it in front of you, because of the vastness of the museum, you still feel like you're forever turning it this way and that way and trying to navigate it. So this means now you have it on your phone if you're there, or if you're at home, you can do it from home, and you just, you know, get your mouse and hover over any area and you can click on any of the rooms, and then it will show you a general photograph of the room. And then underneath it has all of the paintings, say, or sculpture or objects that are in that room. Each of them you can then click on, and you get a fantastic high resolution image. This is the thing that us art historians and teachers are very excited about.
Some of the material that I came across, just like literally wandering around. The level of detail is quite extraordinary indeed. And as you say, that interactive map, very much part of it. But I suppose there's a highlights tour. And the first thing I did when I went onto the website today, I opened up the homepage and immediately, it's the reason most people who are going doing the French for the Paris tour, they go to the Louvre, they want to see the Mona Lisa. It came up on the practically immediately in front of me. You know, and the Mona Lisa, Leonardo da Vinci, obviously. And as we're speaking now, our own colleague Janice will be retweeting the image from the Louvre Twitter account. So we'll be seeing on our page, which is at RTE Arena, we'll be retweeting the images from the Louvre Twitter account Twitter account itself. So let's start with when we go into Mona Lisa. Give us a sense of the sort of detail that we get when we go on the tour, or when we look at this painting, Jess.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that people often say about the Mona Lisa when they see it in person is how small it is and how they can't get anywhere near it. So this is the complete opposite experience to that, because you get to go in, not just, you know, zoom in on the surface details of the varnishes and paint that's, you know, that we can see with the naked eye, but actually you can go in and look at it through infrared, through x-ray, through ultraviolet. So you can see all the underdrawings, all of these things. So from that perspective, it's extraordinary. But even just when you get to look in close at the surface, you can see, you know, elements of the age of it and the kind of damage and things over the years, which the Louvre is actually quite well known for preserving the history of the object rather than try to restore it back to what they imagine it would have originally looked like, which say the National Gallery in London might be more inclined to do. So you really get to see that. And then you also get to examine the tiniest little areas in this close detail to really see the extraordinary technique of Leonardo. And one of the things that he's famed for is atmospheric perspective. So the ability to paint a landscape that looks like it is very naturalistic, very believable. And that's because it fades as it goes off into the distance, and it gets colder in color as it goes off into the distance. So you get to examine exactly where he starts to shift and change that, which is something not that easy to see if you're looking at the overall work. So,
The sort of guidance that you're given on that, though, is quite extraordinary, both in terms of short videos and texts that can crop up at the side. And of course, it's the stories around the paintings as much as anything else that I think are of interest to people. What do we get around explaining the famous smile of the Mona Lisa? How is that given to us?
So the one of the ideas of putting together this online collection was each curator from each department would then have this role of giving us this information. So it's, you know, the top notch sort of people writing this. So essentially what we're looking at is a technique called sfumato, which just in Italian kind of translates to smoky. And it's where you have a very subtle graduation of tone, so that it looks like a kind of smoky eye, if we were thinking about it in today's makeup. And it means that our eye jumps about when we look at it. So it's not giving us just one kind of complete perfect view. Instead, we see more closely to how we naturally see. So it's a kind of optic way of painting. So we think her smile flickers, essentially, because it does, our eyes don't settle because of this soft graduation of tone. So they, you know, very cleverly have an option where you click on observe, and then it sections out parts of the painting that you can click on. And then it gives you these little extra bits of information. And then that little video you mentioned as well comes in the understand section, where it also talks about things like how Marcel Duchamp in the 20th century kind of poked fun at this painting. And, you know, the sort of fame of it and the kind of idea of how the fame of a painting can then affect how it influences art later on.
Yeah, well, the Marcel Duchamp title is worth repeating. So he puts a moustache on her face, effectively.
On a postcard,
kind of makes fun of the painting, as you say. But then he entitles the painting El H O O Cool. So the French students among us might be able to, when you read that out, it becomes El H O O Cool. I know that El Asho means she has something warm. What does O'Cull mean, Jess?
Well, it can mean end, or can mean bottom. So there's also a coarser word that it could mean. But essentially, he's, you know, poking fun at the fact it's the one part of her we can't see. But he's guaranteeing us that that's the case.
Yeah, she has a hot bottom, we can say, I think, without being
yeah.
But it is that kind of looking at how the painting itself. There was also another section in there where it actually it moves into loads of different versions. If you like, are loads of different, I suppose, answers or responses to the original Da Vinci painting
dialogues
as well.
With it. So that was one of the things that I was surprised about, that they, you know, took it to, you know, what would be much more common in a kind of deeper delve into the history of a painting to then sort of compare it to what comes next. So it shows you that their ambition with what they're going to do with the collection overall is really quite exciting, because if they're not just talking about the one object they have, but they're relating it to objects and collections around the world, it really gives a wonderfully comprehensive view of that object. So the Louvre will be almost, you know, a one-stop shop to get really detailed art historical research on these objects and more.
And a few stories around, particularly around the Mona Lisa, wasn't there the famous theft in the early 20th century?
Yeah, arguably that's why this painting is so famous. And I know that's quite a controversial thing to say, but it really wasn't the most famous painting in the world until it was stolen in the 19-teens. And this was because, you know, it was like this kind of Lindbergh baby sort of situation. It was all over all the papers and everyone was, you know, trying to find it. And there was rewards offered and all this kind of craziness around it. It turned out in the end, it was this Italian man who I think had been staff, and he believed that it needed to be brought back to Italy. So he smuggled it back to Italy. And then they said, well, no, we don't actually want you to smuggle it back for us. And it was sent then back to the Louvre. But the Louvre has a long history of owning works that were stolen. So there was about 20,000 works stolen by Napoleon that he then brought to the Louvre. So it's not as if, you know, their hands are clean entirely. But in the case of the Mona Lisa, it went from the artist to the French state quite directly, because Leonardo worked for Francis I.
Right, OK. So nobody's really arguing about whether it's owned by France or not, but there could be arguments about other paintings, I guess. Now, let's put up, we're going to tweet now on at RTE Arena a picture of the Venus de Milo. I want to talk about this piece of sculpture, first of all, but it links us into Louvre Kids, which is another section of the website. What's on offer there?
It's actually really fun stuff. So a lot of little animations. So, for example, for the Venus de Milo, it shows you a little scene from 1820 when this man, you know, this Greek man is on the island of Milos looking for just stone to use to build a wall. And he discovers this underground kind of open space that has this sculpture in it. And it just so happens that there's this French antiquarian there at the same time, and he buys it off him straight away and then brings it back to France. So it gives a kind of fun, sort of cutesy sort of way of showing the story, but actually very informative and doesn't over-exaggerate too much or anything like that. But the general sort of program for kids, I think, is quite good too, and it's almost like kind of little ways of linking them in and bringing them in and entertaining them. But it is interesting to think about something like this being, you know, that sort of famous and that young children that young get to learn about it. You know, it's used in The Simpsons, for example. You know, Homer finds a sweet that is like I can't remember the name of the sweet, but it looks like the Venus de Milo. So those kind of cultural references, learning them early in a fun way like that, I think is great.
Yeah, and as you say, just a way of opening up the works of art to maybe younger viewers and listeners who you just want to get them, have them exposed to them as much as anything else. Now, you chose a specific sculptor for us from Desiderio da Settignano, if I'm saying his name correctly, a relief profile bust of Julius Caesar. Just tell me, first of all, how you got to this, because I think on my initial search, I came across over 35,000 pieces of sculpture that I could look at. I thought, how do I get down to getting just the one I want?
Yeah, so this is the thing. It works in various different ways, as I say. So you can just, you know, use the interactive map to drop in and just be find something surprising. But if, say, for example, you're a researcher and you want to look at specific things, you can, in fact, go in and you can select an explore menu, which either suggests the subject. So you can look at various things like just textiles or just jewellery or just sculpture. And then inside of that, you can narrow the parameters of your search. So, for example, for me, I'm doing a bit of research on 15th century Italian sculpture at the moment. So I just put in Italy as the country of origin, time period 1400 to 1500. That you could just select marble if you wanted. You could search the name of the artist if you knew you just wanted to look at their work. But it means that now you can have all of the selections, you know, that you're interested in comparing, and they'll come up usually on a page of about 24, and you can very quickly look through them. But the images are so good, whereas prior to this, you know, the online catalogue, and it's the same for most museums, don't have images for everything. So Desiderio da Settignano is an unusual and not very well known artist, so he would not often be the artist chosen to have his work digitalized and a photograph taken and put online. So the fact that you now can even find lesser known artists and have this great catalogue entry with all the details you could possibly want in terms of provenance, in terms of bibliography, exhibition history, all of these things, and this image that you can zoom in on in great close detail. So it's just like, you know.
Yeah, I'm just looking at it now on our own Twitter page at RT Arena. We've retweeted the image from the Louvre's Twitter page, so we can see that Julius Caesar head there. And we certainly get that profile bust of Julius Caesar. We get a sense of what a Roman nose is for sure.
Absolutely, yes, yeah. And of course, Desiderio da Settignano is in the Renaissance, so he's sort of using classical antiquity like examples to copy what Julius Caesar may have looked like. But this is from around 1460, and the idea of doing something this way, like almost like a sort of antiquarian's approach, wouldn't have been that typical. And actually, the lifelike quality, almost the sort of aged kind of papery looking skin here, is far beyond the naturalism of many other sculptures of this period. It's only really that he died very young that people don't know that much about him. He has an association with Donatello, and sometimes there is a confusion over which pieces might have been by the more famous artist or the lesser known. But it gives us this wonderful insight into this very particular moment of an adoration of the Roman past by the Renaissance artists.
And how limited then, in overall terms, Jess, is if you go as a virtual visitor onto the website, can you see everything? Can you go your own way, or are there just a few selected tours that you're brought on?
So at the moment, there are a few selected tours. So say, for example, if you wanted to use the virtual tours. So this is something that I've been doing a lot since the lockdown, and, you know, using virtual tours online to bring people, to make them feel like they're going away for an hour to look at a collection. And some are better than others. So, for example, the Vatican Museum one is extraordinary. You can look at the Sistine Chapel ceiling, and it's you can use like high definition glasses and things if you have them to kind of feel like you're really there. In the case here, they've kind of focused in a little bit more on exhibitions, which again is a good idea, because if the collection and the permanent collection is pretty much always exhibited the same way, which it is in the Louvre, you can just go and see it, whereas exhibitions are temporary, so you won't get to see it again. So they've made these a little kind of 360 views of the exhibition space that you can turn around, and then you can select individual objects to look at. And one of the ones that they have up, which I thought was really interesting, was founding myths from Hercules to Darth Vader. Again, you get a sense of them trying to bring in a new audience and perhaps a younger audience. But it's a really clever one, because they show you, you know, the relationship between Greek vases and, you know, neoclassical paintings, and then how, you know, film and cinema use these same types of tropes, these same types of images, and it's really clever.
Things that you know happened during lockdown, you know, where people were recreating famous works of art, maybe using socks or bits of clothing at home, all of that type of thing. I wanted to finish up, maybe it's not quite the same thing, but in some ways it relates to that. This is a piece called The Seasons, or The Four Seasons, from Giuseppe Arcimboldo. Explain what the work is. We'll tweet it as we're talking about it. Explain on at RTE Arena. Explain what that work is, and how this image of the human face is made up.
Yeah, so I think the thing that most people are so surprised about in relation to Archimboldo is that these are from the 16th century, because they feel like they should be surrealist works. And in fact, Salvador Dali was very much inspired by these works, so no surprise there. So basically, it's kind of a trompe-l'oeil, a trick of the eye, where you first think you're just looking at a face, and then as you get closer, you realise that that face is entirely made up of fruit and vegetables. And in this case here, fruit and vegetables that come out in the summer. So this is part of a group of the four seasons, and this was commissioned directly from the artist and meant as a series that would stay together. In fact, it was kind of copied off an earlier commission that the artist had, so it was a famous series in his own lifetime, and this is the second version. So when you look closely, you can see that actually what you think is his mouth is really a pea pod. And there's cherries for his lips. Weirdly, the closer you get to it, the more freaky and sort of bizarre it is, and the more unsettling. In other instances, he also used books to make faces of, you know, the librarian, or fish to make the face of the fish seller, or, you know, so it relates to the person's profession. But in this case, it's the seasons. So yeah, they're just so much fun to look at. And now we have these really high quality images. So it means that you can see what you need to see, which is the weird detail of how, you know, his earlobes actually a garlic clove, you know, these kind of things. But yeah, they're creepy, weird and fun, I think. Yeah.
Well, listen, it's a great way to visit the Louvre. And if we ever do get to a point again when we can actually go to Paris and visit the museum itself, obviously you can bring your smartphone with you and have all of this with you in your pocket. But in the meantime, you can just visit from home, and you don't have to go to it all, which is, even I was thinking, Jess, that it would be an interesting way to plan your visit if you did get a chance to go take a look at the stuff online first of all. Say, yeah, I'm going there, there and there, because you can't do the whole thing in one day. You wreck your head doing that type of thing.
And you get very sore feet and a very sore back very quickly because you're walking really slowly as well. So it's a brilliant idea to do that. So you could absolutely plan it all out in advance and, you know what your route's going to be. Or in fact, as we said before, they give you some routes if you want to just follow Beyonce, for example.
You can see the origins of that video, I suppose, is part of the fun there. Jess, lovely to speak with you as always, and thanks for that evening. Jessica Fahey there telling us about the virtual at the Louvre at home and virtual tour. It's available on, let me give you that website again, louvre.fr/en/online-tours, and maybe we'll retweet that particular website so that it's there on our own Twitter page at RTE Arena, louvre.fr/en/online-tours.